On the 27th of March, the Coffee House Shots team will be joined by special guests to give you their take on a spring statement. We will be live on stage at London's Cadogan Hall. To get your tickets today, visit spectator.co.uk/springstatementlive. We'll see you there.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. It is 2025 and Donald Trump is president once again of the United States. We will, of course, be following the moves of the Donald and his second administration very closely. However, it won't just be politics for us this year. We'll also talk a lot and cover American culture, life, and the arts. I should also remind you, because my producer Natasha will not let me hear the end of it, that we are on Spectator TV. So head to our YouTube channel to watch that. Today we are going to be talking about what else but Donald Trump and Ukraine, because following the spectacular bust-up between Volodymyr Zelensky and President Donald Trump in the Oval Office on Friday, things have not got better, I think it's fair to say. Yesterday, Donald Trump announced that he would be suspending all US military aid to Ukraine and possibly lifting sanctions on Russia. And then last night on Fox News, J.D. Vance got himself into a bit of an international brouhaha.
The very best security guarantee is to give Americans economic upside in the future of Ukraine. That is a way better security guarantee than 20,000 troops from some random country that hasn't fought a war in 30 or 40 years.
Vance has since made clear that he did not mean Britain or France when he said that, although which country he actually meant is hard to decipher. I'm delighted to be joined by Owen Matthews, our Russia correspondent, to discuss this story. Owen, I will start with that J.D. Vance story, which is causing a lot of hubbub on Twitter at the moment. What did you make of his outburst last night?
Yeah, it's extraordinary. J.D. Vance, some people thought that he was going to be like the smartest guy in the room, which in the Trump White House was a relatively low bar. But I mean, he had his admirers. He certainly is not a dumb guy, but his diplomacy by insult seems to indicate very clearly that he has no judgment whatsoever. And it is also, I think, a very clear indicator of poor character that J.D. Vance did actually was a very trenchant critic of Donald Trump some years ago, and right up until, you know, a year ago when he actually became sycophant in chief. So, you know, for his talk of his own sort of military service, I mean, he's a former US Marine, as we know, and his sort of bootstraps story from coming up from, you know, dirt poverty in Appalachia and so on, the guy is a liability. He's crass. He is extremely, I think the most charitable way I would describe him as is, you know, grossly diplomatic and impolitic and certainly, you know, and borderline out of control, to be honest.
Well, I can see that he is, as Disraeli said of Gladstone, a bit inebriated with the exuberance of his own verbosity. But don't we also have to confront the fact that on the basic point, he is right? If you take the random country sentence out of his quote, what he was saying is that for Ukraine to sign the deal and establish an economic security relationship with the United States would be better than the current very contingent European plan to put troops in Ukraine, which we don't know whether Russia will accept that. We think probably they won't. And does Europe really have the ability to do that anyway?
Yeah, I think I strongly concur. Is that actually, if you take out the sort of gratuitous insults, actually Vance is kind of right on more or less every point. He was, that awful humiliating confrontation with Zelensky. Zelensky was in the Oval Office. He was told he didn't have any cards, and he's acting macho because of U.S. help. Both of those things are true. I'm sorry, but it actually happens to be the case. And similarly, Vance is also, as you correctly suggest, completely on the money when he says, you know, that actually it's the US that needs to backstop all of this. The Europeans themselves are saying they should backstop this. And of course, the one thing that Vance didn't really, the one thing that supports Vance's words are the Europeans themselves, because the Europeans, despite all that sort of show of unity and the big words from Kaya Kallas about new leadership of the free world and so on, what was the point of the Lancaster House meeting? It was to prepare a peace plan, not to take to Putin, but to take to Washington. They're like literally second fiddle to Washington still diplomatically, and they themselves admit it. So unfortunately, so Vance's problem is that he's undiplomatic, but at the same time, he's actually correct on most of the things he says.
Isn't the real question here that doesn't really get articulated very well, I think, in most media commentary, is a difference of opinion between the Trump administration and European leaders on the nature of Vladimir Putin's Russia. America doesn't think that Putin is a Hitler-like figure who wants to take over the rest of Europe. And most European leaders, they may not think that necessarily, but they certainly talk as though they think that.
Yes, I think it's true there's three basic truths which the US administration takes as the basis of its approach to Russia. One of them is that whoever the deal over Ukraine, for whatever Biden may have said, no deals over the head of Kiev, any deal for a ceasefire is going to be done between Washington and the Kremlin directly. That's basically a given. We may not like it. We may decry that as the end of the rules-based international order. We may say that that's a sort of, you know, piece of Westphalia type sort of great power carve-up. Whatever we might call it, that's just the truth. That's how it's going to happen. The second basic premise is that the war cannot continue if America ceases supporting Ukraine massively with military aid. I think that's also in practical terms true. Europe has paid more money, but in terms of actually just delivering equipment, Europe doesn't have that capability, even though it may now suddenly have a newfound desire to do it. And the third thing is that actually, ultimately, Europe does not speak with one voice. Who do I call when I call Europe, as was it Henry Kissinger famously said? But the point is that there's strong dissent even inside the allegedly united European front, and that includes the Poles, who have said that they're not going to provide troops on the ground. There are the Hungarians, obviously, who actually, Orban very strongly condemned the European decision to continue the war, and so on. So those three things: lack of European unity, the actual defense weakness of Europe and their inability to support Ukraine, and the fact that Trump and Putin are the ones that are going to end the war, are the bottom line of American policy. And in all those things, we might not like it, but unfortunately, they are just practically true.
And is another factor here that this administration, unlike Trump's first administration in many ways, understands the limits of American power. And you mentioned J.D. Vance's military experience. You also have a defense secretary, Pete Hegseth, who served in Iraq. You have Tulsi Gabbard, director of intelligence, who also served in Iraq. But those three all served in lower combat roles than the people who are making military decisions in the first Trump administration. So they have learned the hard way the limits of American power, and therefore they have a more realistic sense, some might say, of how that power can be applied.
Yes, it is significant that they've all served in junior capacities. The one person who hasn't served famously, of course, is Donald Trump himself. But the point about the experience of anyone who served in the American military, or in fact anyone who is American over the last generation, is that in fact none of those wars went very well. And, that great sort of neoliberal project of the sort of great war on terror and draining the swamp and all those sort of the great ideological battles over the righteous war that brought us Afghanistan, that brought us Iraq, actually completely failed. They didn't bring us Afghanistan. They didn't bring us democracy in the Middle East. Very, very far from it. Instead, they brought us ISIS. They brought us, you know, they encouraged the Arab Spring, which brought us, you know, a military dictatorship in Egypt and total collapse of Libya and so on. It was a complete disaster area. It's very, very hard to point to any kind of positive outcome, either for the countries or for America itself, of that, you know, trillion plus dollars that was spent on the Great War on Terror. So I think it's entirely appropriate that that generation, which is the people surrounding the Trump are of a generation, to seriously question the limits of American power. And or even, I wouldn't even quite put it in the way of as a limit of American power. I think America has enormous power to wage war. What America was doing was not waging war. It was trying to bring regime change and reform parts of the world after winning a war. So it's the American power is still absolutely fine. They still have, you know, a dozen Carrick battle groups. They still got the world's second largest nuclear arsenal. In functional terms, I'm sure the largest functional nuclear arsenal. They can project power to a far greater degree than any other nation in the world. So the hard power, yes. The soft power, the changing regimes stuff, the building nations and funding democracy around the world, it's not working. It hasn't worked. And America has just acknowledged that limitation.
And going back to this relationship between America and Russia at the moment, Trump yesterday also announced a potential for lifting of sanctions on Russia, which is very controversial stuff in Europe. But a lot of Trump administration officials talk about the growing relationship between the growing friendship between Russia and China and how it's strategically important for America to stop that. And so that, therefore, if that means saying nice things occasionally about Vladimir Putin or doing things he might approve of, they're quite willing to do that. From a Russian point of view, how close is the relationship with China? And how much has it grown closer as a result of the Ukraine war?
Well, it's, Ukraine war and the collapse of Western markets have essentially turned Russia into an economic vassal of China. But it's not really the case the other way around. I mean, even after a near sort of doubling of mutual trade, I think it's well over now 200 billion between Russia and China, Russia remains China's 12th or 13th largest trading partner, with the 200 billion versus 1.5 trillion, which is the amount of business they do with the EU and the US. So I think it's really important not to think of this diplomacy, you know, like a risk game, you know, where Russia just seems to be incredibly big and powerful, and actually, and I suspect that's that is the way that some people of Trump's generation and still see it as this sort of terrible bugbear, because actually Russia has less than 2% of the world's population, has less than 2% of the world's economy. To be honest, I mean, it's, you know, and there are various ways that you can calculate it, but you know, just for dollar for dollar terms, not in purchasing power parity terms, it's something like, it's akin to South Korea and Australia. It's really very, very small country. The one thing it has is a seat on the Security Council, and it has a massive arsenal of nuclear weapons. And even its supposedly fantastic army, which everyone simultaneously in Europe predicts will imminently collapse if the Ukrainians keep fighting, but also might then progress and take Helsinki and Warsaw. It's like Schrödinger's army. It's like simultaneously the most terrifying and the most pathetic army in the world. But currently, the fact of the matter is that, as Zelensky himself joked, NATO has not shown up to this fight, really. It's just the Ukrainians beat the Russian army in the field. The Ukrainians did it. So in terms of how important is it to make friends with Putin strategically, I mean, honestly, it's like Putin is just small change in terms of more or less every economic metric except for one, and that is his energy exports. He does export one thing that is important strategically to the world, and that is oil and gas. But again, with oil and gas, they have not been able to pivot their gas production to China for complicated technical reasons that can be summarized in one sentence: is pipelines are expensive. Russia has no gas pipelines to China to speak of, and Power of Siberia 1, Power of Siberia 2. I mean, it's all sort of just pie in the sky. So actually, even in energy terms, it's not as though Russia is this sort of great lucrative prize that, you know, that without Russian energy, China's economy collapses. Absolutely not, really not, because they currently, China supplies something like 10% of China's gas supplies. And as you know, they have massive supplies of coal. That's why they're building 2 coal power stations a week. Ed Miliband, take note.
Let's assume that the worst fears for the Trump administration's deal with Ukraine are true, and that the deal falls through. There's no minerals agreement, and that Ukraine is left with Europe as its ally and not America. I touched on this at the beginning, but I wonder how true do you think is it for me to say Russia's never going to accept European troops in Ukraine as a security guarantee?
Remains to be seen. I've actually heard some rumors that in fact the Russian objections may not be quite as adamant as all that. But the one thing that actually I think lots of people are moving away from is frontline peacekeepers, because I think that's actually quite a risk for the West. As well, actually, that's too much of a tripwire. That's like too high an a risk. So one idea that's been floated is several battalions armed, in Strykers, which are large infantry fighting vehicles, like sort of mobile, and they have a mobility of 1,000 kilometers a day. So even if you station them on the western border of Ukraine, they can just in a few hours be on the front lines. Or you can station them in Poland on the Polish side of the border as a sort of rapid reaction force. That's also a possibility. Actually, the real elephant in the room is not the European troops on the ground, although that is one important symbolic element. The practical thing that will actually keep Ukraine safe is a missile system called THAAD. That's Terminal High Altitude Area Defense. And basically what it does is that it collects the Patriot batteries that Ukraine already has, combines it with a system, with a seaborne system called Aegis, and basically it's an iron dome for Ukraine. I mean, that's actually, you know, a really practical thing that the United States could do. It's very expensive. Technology is very expensive, very, very sensitive. So far, Washington hasn't done it, but it is a practical thing that they can do to protect Kiev against and Ukraine against Russian future attack, is providing THAAD. But that's just one of the elements. The bottom line that we have to remember is that, unfortunately, neither the Ukrainians nor even America have come up with a way of forcing Putin to do anything. There is no compellence strategy as yet. And we can either defeat him in the field, or if he cannot be defeated in the field in any reasonable way, apart from literally going to war against him, NATO going to war against him, which is an escalation, I think, too far even for the Europeans, then any peace deal has to be agreed by Putin. And that's the bottom line of it. And unfortunately, despite all the crassness of J.D. Vance, despite the rudeness of Trump, I don't think that anyone other than Trump has a serious chance. Because what are the Europeans going to do? They say they're going to bring the Ukrainians to the table. The Ukrainians, unfortunately, if you have the Ukrainians at the table, then you have no deal, sadly. It's only Trump and Putin that really have a chance. And the cost of that, of course, is going to be high for Ukraine. The way to look at it is not whether the cost is going to be high, whether Ukraine's going to be sold down the river, does the United States have a right to give away Ukrainian territory? All those are legitimate questions. You can stack them up to like a mile high. But the other side of the balance is, what happens to Ukraine if it fights on? And that question was answered by the chief of its military intelligence, a very impressive guy called Major General Kirill Budanov, who warned a closed session of the Rada of Ukraine's parliament back in December, that there's a very real chance of a catastrophic military and political collapse of Ukraine if by this summer, if it fights on. So, you know, the price of peace is going to be high. And everyone, including Zelensky, is going to cry betrayal, stab in the back, yes. But actually, there's quite a lot of Ukrainians lining up behind a different theory, and that actually is, if we don't stop, then we're going to kill Ukraine. We're going to lose far, far more.
And that being the case, Zelensky then will either have to eat humble pie and go back to Washington and sign the deal, or he'll probably have to go in one way or another.
Yeah, I think he, to be honest, I think he has to go. That's unfair in all kinds of ways. Again, like, you know, get in line. There are like a million objections, and they're all completely valid. But if the question is, you know, Zelensky staying in power or a ceasefire, I think even Zelensky would take that. I mean, Zelensky has already said, I mean, rather foolishly, in my opinion, he said, like, I would step down if NATO gave us membership. I mean, that's obviously a stupid thing to say. But nonetheless, the principle is an honorable one, is that, you know, I will step down if that's what it takes to get Ukraine, to save Ukraine. So if, given that there's a lot of debate over what his true ratings are, if you ask people whether they trust Zelensky, then you get the numbers that you're seeing quoted by the Zelensky supporters of like 54%, 61% trust Zelensky. So davirie, trust. If you ask them, will they re-elect Zelensky, as the Kiev Institute of Economics did at the end of November, so slightly out of date, but nonetheless, in November, only 16% of respondents said that they would re-elect Zelensky. So there's a big debate over whether he would actually get back into power. But if the question is, if the Trump administration insists that he steps down, there's a way to do that without actually having new elections. And that is that he steps down in favor, I mean, it's written in the Constitution, in favor of the Speaker of the Rada, who, by the way, is a member of Zelensky's party, Stepanchuk. And by the way, a former intellectual property lawyer for Zelensky, who set up his, who was involved in his financial affairs when he was a television producer. You can read the Panama Papers for details of that. But the
Pandora Papers. I keep getting through it. It's the Pandora Papers, isn't it?
Pandora Papers, a big pun for details of that. But the point is that the there is a way for there to be an interregnum for Zelensky to step down and there to be an administration until, because otherwise you have a complete deadlock. You have no ceasefire while Zelensky's in power. You know, Zelensky is in power, and but no elections until a ceasefire. So it becomes like a sort of a vicious circle. But there is a way to break that. We're not at that situation yet. No one said there's not going to be a ceasefire until Zelensky goes. And I think if that becomes a demand of the Kremlin, that would be a very stupid thing for the Kremlin to demand. I mean, I think I'm 1,000,000% sure that's what the Kremlin wants. But would it be a smart thing for the Kremlin to make that part of their demands? I mean, that would really be ugly. That would really, like, you know, we won't sign unless you literally sort of throw Zelensky under a bus. I mean, maybe even the Trump administration would balk or something like that, but maybe not. I mean, their appetite for appalling the world is seems to be nearly infinite.
Well, if Zelensky does go, somebody we have talked about before is Zeluzhny, who has been the Ukraine's ambassador in London, but yesterday, rather bizarrely, Zelensky appointed him the representative for the International Maritime Organization. Tell us a little bit about him. How would he differ from Zelensky? How likely is he to get the job? I mean, is it a shoo-in or what?
It's very interesting. Zaluzhny has done one thing absolutely right, is that he has kept absolutely shtum. Because I've been ringing around and you know WhatsApping every single person I know in Kiev, asking like you know what's up with Zaluzhny, like any movement, like you know is any organization, has he says anything, like who's lining up behind him, who's not, absolutely nothing, silence. And he himself has been extremely discreet and actually hasn't even seen journalists even off the record that I've seen. That I've heard of. So that suggests that he's shrewd, at least in like keeping his light under a bushel. As to whether he's a shoo-in, who knows? I mean, Ukraine. He has an enormous military reputation, but it's already somewhat old. And he did preside over the complete failure of Ukraine to make any breakthroughs between October 22 and summer 23 when he was fired. So he's it's very hard to predict. I mean, so far he's. He has been the sort of Ukraine's king across the water, but again, these polls are very hard to it's very hard to sort of make any hard conclusions about these polls. Not least because Ukraine doesn't really have any legal opposition political activity or any mainstream opposition media because it's a state of emergency. So it's very hard to tell.
And lastly, Owen, going back to Donald Trump, it's probably a safe bet, so he's not going to win a Nobel Peace Prize. But if, for all the diplomatic theatrics we've seen in the last few days, there is a peace, and Donald Trump is the reason for that peace, the main driver of that peace, could you not perhaps argue that he deserves one?
Well, actually, like, strangely enough, just as Zelensky could have said all the same things that he said in the room in the Oval Office and like not triggered like a massive storm of negativity and opprobrium and disaster. He could have just been a little bit more diplomatic. In the same way, Trump could very much be in line for a Nobel Peace Prize if he was actually less confrontational, obnoxious to everybody. It's not part of his winning formula, by the way, to suddenly throw Zelensky under a bus, insult him, pull the funding. All of that stuff is not a necessary requirement of making a deal with Putin. If he brings peace to Ukraine at the cost of, he will be accused of bringing peace to Ukraine at the cost of essentially surrendering 22% of Ukrainian territory. That's actually a really stupid way to look at it. It's foolish because not only is that territory not being surrendered, it has been conquered by Russia through expenditure of gigantic amounts of blood and treasure. They literally took it, and if anyone wants it back, they're going to have to do the same and take it back. No one's giving anything to anybody in a peace deal. We're just talking about land that's already been taken. But I think that the bottom line in terms of a peace prize is, can you achieve a lasting peace? The terms of the peace are less important than than whether it sticks. I mean, you could say that every peace includes terribly sordid, awful compromises. I mean, the Good Friday Agreement with Ireland literally let out hundreds of people who were convicted of horrific crimes, and many of those IRA criminals are not just walking free, but actually literally part of the government of the province these days. I mean, that's by the lights of many an incredibly ugly compromise, but nonetheless peace was achieved. Every peace requires compromise, and that's it will be, I think, an unfairness to Trump if he actually, in the event that he actually brings about a lasting, stable, prosperous Ukraine, is created as a result of a deal that he makes, then I think he probably does deserve a peace prize. The land was gone anyway. It's not on Trump that the land was lost. But the peace is something that I think only he is realistically capable of making at this moment.
Well, and as you put it so well in the last show we did together, what's the Russian phrase? Say it in Russian. A thin peace is better than a fat wall.
Yeah, exactly. Худой мир лучше доброй ссоры. Exactly.
On that note, we shall end it there. Thank you very much, Owen. Thank you for listening to that episode of Americano. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave a review on whatever platform you are watching or listening to it on. We prefer positive reviews, although some constructive criticism is also welcome. I'd also urge you to sign up to the Americano newsletter, which I write every week. It comes out on Thursdays, and people seem to be enjoying it so far. Thank you very much to the audience. Thanks also to my producer, Natasha Feroz, for doing such a wonderful job. And speak to you next time.